From the studios of Teeing It Up in the swamps of Jersey, this is Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling, where we welcome in Jared Dubin and welcome him back to Teeing It Up to preview the NBA Finals between the Celtics and the Warriors. Jared, you were a fan-requested guest. How does that make you feel?
Feels great. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. And I want to thank Stu and Kyle and Jordan and everybody else who submitted questions on the analytics side for these finals to Jared. That is something that is not usual for Teeing It Up, and we enjoy all of it. So thank you. Let's start with this. You write for the NFL on CBS. You write basketball articles for, I feel like, 86 different outlets. Where is the easiest place for people to figure out where your stuff is?
Right now it's mostly at 538. But I guess if you follow me on Twitter and want to, you know, get links I send out there, I'm at JADubin5, and it's mostly, you know, links to my stories, jokes about nonsense, and my takes on TV.
Basically. And speaking about, you know, the laughs that are on your Twitter feed, and especially your Instagram feed, for those of us who have known you for such a long time, what do you think you're going to do more in 2022? Post pictures of Bodie or write about the Jets' success?
That's not going to be close. It's definitely going to be dot pictures. I mean, even if the Jets had a ton of success, let's say the Jets won the Super Bowl, I can't imagine that I personally would be writing about them still more than like 5 or 6 times. Like, we would have other people write about them sometimes. So, I mean, even if it was the best year in the history of the Jets, it would still be more pictures of the dog.
Well, I'll try to get Bodie to behave more normally, which would then allow you to write more about the Jets or whoever else.
You can try. It's not going to happen.
All right, so let's dive into this. From an outsider's perspective, from someone like me who played the game recreationally, as you know, and was not very good, I look at a team like the Warriors and I say, okay, they got Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, and a whole bunch of other really good supporting pieces. We know that Steph and Klay are going to get their 30 or their 32, and Draymond will get a whole bunch of rebounds, and you kind of got to live with that and limit everybody else. Is that your philosophy, or are you trying to take somebody or a part of somebody's game out of this?
I don't necessarily think about the Warriors' offense in terms of stopping or slowing individual players so much as actions. Like, you have to be really locked in on their split action, where they throw it into the post, and then Steph and Klay, or Steph and Poole, or Klay and Poole, or Klay and Wiggins, or whoever, you know, will screen for each other, and one of them will cut to the basket, and one of them will float out to the 3-point line. You have to really be locked in on that. You have to really be locked in on the Steph Draymond pick and roll, and you have to really be locked in on preventing them from getting out in transition. So to me, it's more about paying attention to certain actions or certain situations than it is to pay attention to certain players, or we're going to stop Steph, or we're going to stop Klay, or whatever it is.
So, you know, you were talking about being turnover prone and getting yourself out of position and then being sloppy and transition opportunities for the Warriors, which we know they feast on. For Boston, in this series, there was a fan question about, are they turnover prone just because of them? Is it that the Warriors make teams more turnover prone? Or is it Boston actually making good plays and being out of sync? So this is almost two questions. Is Boston turnover prone, or is that just the Warriors' tendency to make teams look prone to turnovers? And then secondly, are there good turnovers if the offensive sets you were trying to get into just did not form but were smart ideas?
Boston was not particularly turnover prone in the regular season, has been somewhat more turnover prone in the playoffs. I think we saw that, you know, especially the last two rounds where there are just games where they turn it over like a million times. The Warriors are more turnover prone than almost any team in the league. They have the second highest turnover rate in the NBA, and a high turnover rate has been a staple of their teams during the Steve Kerr era, but it's like a function of their offense. I don't know that there are necessarily good turnovers that come from them, but because of the way they move the ball and move the players on the court, and so much of their offense is based on cutting and trying to beat opponents through the back door, when you pass the ball more often, there are more opportunities to turn the ball over. And because they pass the ball so often, I believe they were second in the NBA in passes per 100 possessions this year. So they pass the ball quite a lot, and they throw a lot of adventurous passes. They're going to turn the ball over more. I don't know what the second question means about the Warriors forcing Boston to be turnover prone. They haven't played them yet, so it can't be the Warriors forcing Boston to be
turnover. I think it was more during the regular season. Was it during their two matchups? Was the
I mean, that's some of that is just variance. Some of that is the Warriors force turnovers. Yeah, like there's going to be teams that you turn the ball over against more often than other teams because you play 82 games and you're going to turn the ball over a certain amount of times in every game. You know, one of those 82 games is going to be the game where you turn the ball over the most.
That is very true. And if that's one of the two, it may stand out more than if it's, you know, the team in your own division who you're playing 1,000 times. Jared Dubin with us here on Teeing It Up as we look at this NBA Finals between the Celtics and Warriors. How would you defend Tatum and Brown right now? And then who would you switch on to them in the half court if you're Golden State?
I think that it's pretty straightforward. Like, they're going to put Wiggins on Tatum and Clay on Jaylen Brown, if only because they basically have to do that. You know, maybe they could put Clay on Horford or Robert Williams if they want to get themselves in cross matches, and put Draymond on Jaylen Brown. I wouldn't be surprised if we see that at some point. Or maybe they put Draymond on Smart, so they can deal with the Tatum Smart pick and roll, but then you're talking about putting somebody, you know, much smaller on either Williams or Horford, and then who does Steph guard at that point if he's not guarding Smart? So you get into some less than ideal matchups if you do something like that, but yeah, I mean, the Warriors are going to do what they do. I don't know that they're necessarily going to crap something specific against Boston. I mean, they are obviously going to do specific things, but I don't know that they're going to drastically change their defensive game plan. Like, they're going to put Wiggins on the most threatening wing guy, which is Tatum, and they're going to put Clay on the next guy, and they're going to have Draymond roam as much as he can. That's what they do.
One of the interesting things to me about the Warriors is because they had all these injuries, you get guys like Kuminga, like Looney, like Poole, to just move up and advance as far, you know way further way further skill set evolution than they otherwise would have. And you look at Gary Payton, Otto Porter Jr., and Iggy, who have all been out, who have had over a week to rest, and especially Gary Payton. I feel like him on the defensive end could be a real boost for Golden State if he's back and if he's himself. And I guess that's just the big question mark right now as we sit here 2 days before the final start on this May 31st.
Yeah, him and Kuminga could both be pretty helpful defensively. Porter to a certain extent as well, although I think he helps more on offense just because of the way he moves, the way he shoots, and the way he just knows what he's doing on that side of the court. But Yeah, I mean, Peyton specifically could be a huge help defensively.
One of the things about the Celtics run that has been really interesting to me is that both Williamses, who have battled injuries at various times and have battled other things that have had them out, both Robert and Grant have tend to become perfect side pieces for Smart, Tatum, and Brown. When you look at the Celtics' success statistically, when you dove into the numbers to look at how they're actually doing this, is it the role players? Is it the star players? How the heck did they get to this point this far?
Well, both. I mean, nobody gets this far without both of those things contributing. You know, obviously Tatum, to start the year, was shooting, I don't know, like 10% or whatever it was. And obviously not 10%, but it was really bad for the first, you know, month and a half of the season, and then him getting back to, you know, actually connecting on the shots that he was creating. It wasn't like he wasn't playing well. He just wasn't shooting well. And then the defensive changes they made halfway-ish through the year, where basically instead of having Robert Williams defend the other team's center, they would have him guard, you know, the least threatening player on the floor and just rove all around and sort of cut off lanes to the basket. That took their defense to a different level. I think that they were 5 or 6 points per 100 possessions better than the next closest defense in the league after they made that switch, and that's sort of what carried them through the rest of the year. And obviously Tatum and Brown do the heavy lifting for the most part offensively, but it's not like those other guys don't contribute on offense. You know, this was Smart's best season of his career as a passer and a point guard. Horford played really well. Robert Williams gives them, you know, a vertical spacing element that nobody else on the team does. Grant Williams shot 40%+ from three. Like, that all contributes to them being where they are now. It's not just one thing or the other.
You know, the Horford thing to me is just really interesting, because when you look at him on TV and you've seen him in person, at floor level, I never have. 10.7 rebounds a game during the season, 3 assists. The dude doesn't look very big on TV for some reason, but he's 6'9", 240. And is great defensively and offensively. It's all you can ask for somebody who also gives maximum effort every single night. And that, I think, is what has been really interesting to me as we look at these at this finals, which is you have two teams with guys that give maximum effort every single night. And for the Celtics, I would look at Horford as the best effort player on that roster, arguably, if that stat happens to exist somewhere in the world.
What was the stat that you asked for? You cut off a little bit there.
The maximum effort stat. And I'm not sure that stat exists, but Horford to me just gives maximum effort, 6'9", 240. He doesn't look it on TV, but it just seems like he gives maximum effort every single night in a series where both teams are going to give maximum effort. Just because of how they're built and how they're coached.
Yeah, I mean, he's just really good. And a lot of times, the maximum effort, like, he doesn't necessarily have to give maximum effort because he's so smart that he's in the position he needs to be in before he needs to be there. So the physical exertion is not as great as it might be, you know, if a player who didn't know exactly what they were doing, and they might have to, you know, get to a spot much quicker than Horford does because he's already there, or they're at a position and then they need to, you know, generate a lot of force, and they may not be, you know, they can get there because they're fast enough or athletic enough. He can't do that, so he needs to be in the right spots all the time. I remember talking to Marc Gasol about that a few years ago, and, you know, Horford at this point is, you know, similarly late in his career. It's the same kind of thing.
Jared Dubin with us here on Teeing It Up. Everybody knows the famous death lineup that the Warriors trotted out back in the old part of this dynasty. What do you think that closing lineup is going to be for the Warriors? And if you're Boston, how the heck do you stop it?
I think it'll probably depend on the game. Like, I would imagine you're going to see Steph, Clay, Draymond, probably Wiggins, because he's going to need to be out there against Tatum, and then it'll sometimes it'll be Poole, sometimes it'll be Looney, sometimes maybe it'll be, who knows, Tatum, Porter, whoever, like, depending on, you know, what, how that game is going and what Kerr thinks they need in that situation. You know, as far as how to defend it, it's the same things we talked about, you know, in the first question. Like, you got to be locked in on their specific actions. You got to make sure everybody on the ball and off the ball is tuned into their responsibilities 100% on every trip down the floor.
For those out there who like the X's and O's and like looking at basketball from a very specific sense, Golden State is doing well in this series if what specific action is working, and then vice versa, Boston is doing is succeeding offensively if what specific action is working.
I would say for Golden State, it's the split action, where it's, you know, they throw it into the post and then two guys screen for each other in like an X motion, and one of them cuts and one of them pops out to three, and then the Steph Draymond pick and roll. And then for Boston, it's the Tatum Smart or Tatum White pick and roll.
Derek White has come along really quickly. Maybe I'm just naive to it, but have you expected, or did you expect coming into these playoffs for him to play as well as he has, especially in the conference finals against Miami?
Well, he, for the first like 6 or 7 games of the playoffs, was like awful. It was like to the point where, you know, they have to have Peyton Pritchard on the court because he couldn't make a shot. I think through the first 6 games, I'm looking at it now, he shot 28% from the field and 16% from three. It was pretty ugly. And then he had, I think the game that Smart sat out, finally had a pretty decent game. He just went 0-for-6 in that game. It was the next game where he was pretty good. And then he's had, you know, a few more strong games since then. But, I mean, he's been a good player his whole career. It's, you know, his jumper has not been very consistent, and especially during the regular season with Boston, it was not very consistent. But when he's making shots, and specifically when he's being aggressive, he's just a really valuable player because he's a great defender. He has good size. He's like 6'4", 200 pounds or whatever it is. So he can switch. He can get into ball handlers. He can play against, you know, anybody in the backcourt for the most part. And then when he's aggressive, he's a valuable offensive player too. It's the times where he's being too tentative and not being willing to take the shot that he sort of gets into trouble and starts making things bog down.
Jared Dubin with us here on Teeing It Up. I'm going to combine a couple questions into one because I think that it's a really interesting way of looking at this. This Boston team, that was a physical series against the Heat, no doubt, and it's a shorter turnaround time for them, obviously, than Golden State. Is the formula for beating Golden State still being physical, or is there a way that Boston can win this series if they're still tired and or sluggish looking, especially games 1 and 2, even though there are now more days off in between most of these games except for game 3 and 4?
I would say, first, I don't think there is a formula for beating Golden State. Like, they've lost 2 playoff series in 7 years or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, one of them was when Draymond got suspended for hitting LeBron in the nuts, and one of them was when KD got hurt and Klay got hurt, and they were basically just physically worn down after 5 straight years of going to the finals. The Celtics are the only team in the league with a winning record against them during the Steve Kerr era.
Yeah.
And they play bigger, and they do play more physical than the Warriors do, but every team plays bigger than the Warriors do. So it's not like that's, you know, a secret that Boston has unlocked. And I do think that some of the, they have a winning record against them, is they play them less often. It's easier to have a winning record against a team when you only play them twice a year as opposed to 4 times a year when they're as good as these Warriors are. So, you know, they have a winning record, but it's over, you know, like 14 games or whatever it is. And it's just easier to do that than when you're playing them 30 times when they're winning 80% of their games.
And I wonder, as a fan on the couch, if Boston's running more early and trying to get those fast break points, is that a good sign, or could they be wearing themselves out early? I guess what I'm trying to say is there a chance there is a Game 7 wall that the Celtics potentially hit at some point early in this series because of just how many games these guys have logged?
It's possible. You know, we tend to analyze that specific issue, like the whole rest versus rust thing. It tends to be like ex post facto reasoning. If the team that was rested wins, then that means the other team was rusty. And if the team that was playing Game 7 wins, then that means that the other team, you know, had too long of a layoff. They were rusty. So I don't necessarily know that it can be one or the other. We've seen it work both ways in the past. It obviously can work either way in this series. I don't think that, you know, Boston running, you know, in the context of one game is what's going to make them tired or break down later in the series. It's the accumulation of having played, you know, 100-plus games already. I think exactly 100 for them right now, because they went 7 twice and 4 in the first round, which is 18 and 82. So 100 games is what causes you to wear down much more than playing fast in a game or two.
Right. Last couple here for Jared Dubin here on Teeing It Up. How do you stop Jordan Poole?
I mean, the same way you stop the rest of the Warriors offense. It's not like they're running anything particularly different for him. It's, you got to be locked in on the split action. You got to be locked in Steph Draymond pick and rolls. You got to pay attention to these guys when they're off the ball just as much as when they're on the ball.
And finally, if you're looking at this series from an analytics perspective, whether it's Second Spectrum or some kind of other analytics, who should win this series?
I don't know that that necessarily is like an analytics question. you know, in the context of a playoff series, it's really all about matchups. It's, you know, you can have, you know, the numbers can tell you, or not tell you, but, you know, no matter what numbers you have, if one team figures out the other's defense or figures out the other's offense before the other one does, and that other team can't adjust, then the team that figures it out first is going to win the series. Playoff series are essentially battles of who is going to crack the code of either how to score or how to stop the other team first, and then how the team that gets stopped or scored on adjusts to that, and whether you can swing that balance in one direction or the other. And that's much more about individual matchups and scheming than it is about, you know, how they have played to this point. Like, it really doesn't matter how you, like, once you're in the NBA Finals, it really does not matter how you played in the Conference Finals, because you're not playing the team that you played in the Conference Finals anymore. You're playing a whole new team. Yeah. Every series is its own organism.
It's very true, and I think that especially when it comes to, I think, at least for me as just a basketball fan on the couch, if I were trying to stop Steph Curry, I would not look to how I stop Jimmy Butler or anybody on the Heat. I would try to figure out how I would stop Steph Curry. And I think we're all guilty of looking at past series sometimes as like indicators, and then looking at the data looking for indicators, where it's basically, you know, can you stop this person, and is this person guardable? And I think that's what it sometimes comes down to, and we as fans tend to forget that, I think, sometimes. So it's a great point you make. Just as the basketball fan / player, Jared Dubin, who do you think wins this series?
It's really tough. Like, I think it's two very similar and very evenly matched teams. I think it's going 7, and I honestly don't know who wins. I mean, it's hard to see the Warriors losing a Game 7 at home. Granted, it's the Chase Center and not Oracle, but it would be really difficult to see that happening. But the Celtics did just win a Game 7 on the road in Miami, so it's not like it can't be done. I know it's a cop-out. I really don't know who's going to win. I don't have to make a prediction for any of my jobs, so I'm just going to say I think it's going to be an awesome series, and I think it will end up going the distance, and if it doesn't, then I am excited to see how that happens.
And it all starts Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ABC. Keep up the complaints about the late. The complaints about the late starts. You were on to something, Jared, but let's fix this permanently.
It makes no sense. Start the game at the start time and show pregame introductions on TV.
For those, like, you know, people like me who have known Jared personally for years, you've been advocating this for what, like 20 years? 25? I mean,
since I've been watching basketball, I've wanted them to show pregame introductions on TV. It doesn't make sense that they don't do it. And the start time thing is really more since I started covering the league, but it is annoying how, like, every game starts, whatever it is, like, between 7 and 16 minutes late. Just, like, if the game's going to start at 8:46 and not 8:30, list the start time as 8:46.
Thank you. Yep. No, you are 100% correct. Jared Dubin, thanks as always, dude, for coming on Teeing It Up. I greatly appreciate your time on what is a very busy week for you.
No problem, man. Thank you for having me.
You got it. And thank you all for listening to this edition of Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling.